Harihi Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahaviryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavaditamastama Vidvishavahai Om Shanti 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 Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Chaitanya Upanayana, Nyaya Sutras, page 31. Srila Madhvacharya in his Vishnu Tattva Vinirnaya gives the following points about proving the existence of God. The existence of God cannot be proved by any inference, for inference of equal force can be adduced against the existence of God. If it is urged that the world, being in effect, must have a creator or maker, just as a jug has a potter for its maker, then it may also be urged, on the contrary, that the world is without any maker, like the self. If it is urged that the self is not an effect, and that therefore the counter-argument does not stand, then it may also be urged that all makers have bodies, and since God has no body, God cannot be the creator. Thus the existence of God can only be proved on the testimony of the scriptures, and they hold that God is different from the individual selves. If any scriptural test seems to indicate the identity of God and self, or of God in the world, this will be contradicted by perceptual experience and inference, and consequently the monistic interpretations of these texts will be invalid. Now the scriptures cannot suggest anything which is directly contradicted by experience, for if experience be invalid, then the experience, the validity of the scriptures will also become invalid, because unless if it goes against what is perceived, then how do you apply what the scripture says into your life? How do you understand it? Because you're always going to understand through that medium of samskara. It's what your perception is, you know, or has been, then the explanation of it is going to be in connection with that. I'm not saying that what you've seen or that is correct, but that's where you're going to start, because you take a perception as valid. And so then we have to connect the scriptural, the references to your experience through the process of logic, you know, through inference. You know, because we're going to give a point and we're going to give examples and we're going to say similarly like this, and you know, so you're going to have to bring it to you. And then it'll work. So it can't contradict. That's why in the scriptures so many things that you have seen, the examples are always something that is common that everybody has seen. You know? So it'll always be along that, you know, something that either is seen or you have a, like, let's say you haven't necessarily seen a marriage party on a boat, you know, that had the anchor in all night and they were rowing, but you know rowing, you know boats, you know marriage parties, you know anchors, and so you put all that together, you can relate to the example. You know, like that. So the point is it doesn't contradict, because a reflection doesn't contradict. But the problem is they're not understanding the nature of the original. The teaching of the scriptures gains additional strength by its consonance with what is perceived by other pramanas. And since all the pramanas point to the reality of diversity, the monistic interpretation of scriptural texts cannot be accepted as true. When any particular experience is contradicted by a number of other pramanas, the experience is thereby rendered invalid. Right, so you can say these things, but you don't have that experience. That the point is these things are considered. It's not that pratyaksha is the praman, It's just that Shabda doesn't contradict it. It may be given in a way that we haven't seen because of our values, but then through the process of inference, then you can bring it to some point that they relate to, and then... Does that make sense? You know, it's just like, let's say, it was giving the example that somebody, they had never grown up with a father or father figure. So when you say God's the Father, it didn't mean anything to them. So, but then there's going to be something that is there that they see as authority, and therefore then it regulates things and they have a control. You have to take it to that. You know, and then from that, then you can get everything else. So he's pointing out that through logic and inference, you won't understand God. But in context of scripture, you use pratyaksha and anuman. Then it has a value. So it's the same way as the same thing. It's what we see is that in the non-contradictory aspect, through that consonance, is that the same way as Bhagavatam is saying about varnashram doesn't have any, will not show you God. But you practice it in context of God, in devotion, as is given by the acharyas, as given by Shabda, by the authorities and the optas, then it will give you that effect. So in the same way is that if it's in line with authority of the scriptures, then you use Shabda, pratyaksha and anuman, then you can get an understanding. Because you're starting with that, and then in that context, you're analyzing and you're trying to see. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like the pillar is God. Okay, but you know, everything's God, so how's the pillar God? But then Krishna, you see in the Gita, talks about he is the, what's the unique point of the thing? What makes it what it is? So why have a pillar? Because it's got the strength to hold up the roof. Right? So that's the point, is that strength that the pillar has to hold up the roof, that strength is Krishna. You know, it's not about it's the bricks or it's the this or that, it's that strength of the, that. Yes?
Maharaj, here Srila Mahacharya said that it's not possible to prove the existence of God, not about his nature, about his existence. And Thomas Aquinas, he gave the five proofs that God does exist, logical proofs, based on Aristotle's logic.
Yeah, but I mean, as long as it means, the point is he'll give those things, and they may be logical, but someone else who's more clever can come up with something to counter it. That's why it's amazing. He said, here, for inference of equal force can be adduced against the existence. Whatever it is, it's just like, let's say you look on the internet. You look up something, right? Is this thing good for you? And you'll look, and so many people will say how it's the worst thing, but then, you know, and that, and prove everything like that. Someone else will prove how it's the best thing for you. You know what I'm saying? So that's the whole thing, is that it goes like I was just hearing yesterday. The brain functions off of glucose. But glucose is drawn from the intestines. So that means you have to take some form of something that can be converted into sugar, into glucose, that then the brain can use. They did tests where I don't know how they did it, they reduced, so you can't taste anything or something? And so they did it with rats first, of course you always have to start with rats. And then after it works on the rats, then you work with the ones in the rat race, you know, the bigger ones, like that. And so, and they gave them plain water, and they gave them water that had some amount of sugar, you know, sweetener in it. So you can't taste the difference, and you can't tell by anything, by looking at them, everything's the same. So in the beginning, the rats would take some of this, some of that, but with time, they would only take the sugar water. And people the same. They would be quicker. They would take, you know, that's just like that, but then they prefer to take this one. They don't know why. Because the brain uses, you know what I'm saying? So all the thing about no sugar, no this, no that, no carbohydrates, is then the point is then that's all right if you don't want your brain to work. You know what I'm saying? If you want your brain to work, you have to take these things. So that's the thing. It's on one side, it's sugar will kill you. Anything will kill you. Can you live without air? But what happens if you get too much air? You hyperventilate, you'll die. So anything too much, water, without water you'll die, but if you take too much water you'll die. So that's the whole thing. Anything out of balance will kill you. Somebody says it doesn't matter, it will all get you. So therefore is that there's always going to be that thing. It's whatever it is, it's going to be one saying the exact opposite. You know, the Ayurveda, salty and sweety, salt and sweet, nourishes the body. It gives nourishment. But these are the two that are attacked by the Western dietitians. Specifically those two. They don't go after sour, bitter, pungent, or astringent. They don't even talk about it. Who even knows it exists, right? Who eats sour except kids? In the West.
Huh? Astringent? Does it exist?
Yeah, they don't even know about astringent. You know? Pungent? Yeah. In the West, who eats pungent?
Bitter also.
Bitter? They don't eat bitter?
It's not part of the scene.
Yeah. I mean, unless, as you get older, you start to drink black coffee because it's bitter. Because it at least a little help your liver on that side. You know?
Every one of them take bitter knowledge in the form of medicine.
Yeah. Yeah, going to work every day is bitter. It's a bitter experience. That's good for your liver. You know, paying your taxes, paying, you know, all these things are bitter. So it just goes like that. So they only attack those two. But why? Because they overdo them. But why don't they just say what is balanced? Don't say, try to stay under this. No, just say, take these and this amount of things, this kind of diet. This is what we were saying before. There is no Western diet. So they just, you know, try to regulate this or that. But, you know, that's not the way it works.
I don't do much in moderation, though. It's like, you just tell me what the best thing is and I'm just going to
take that.
As
yeah,
much
yeah.
as I can.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's what it is. If a little is good, more is better.
Right.
That's an American ism. You know, that was like that's one of the main aphorisms there, you know. I always remember that. You're taking you know, like they say brewery's yeast is good, you know. I mean you figure out how to, you know, make it into paste and put it on top of your head so it soaks in. You know, it's just like it's just whatever it is you're totally into. That's why you see these health food freaks every few weeks or so they have to change what they do because How much quinoa can you eat? At some point it's just overload, and so the body doesn't need it anymore. So then, you know, you eat it, you don't like it, so now this is the new thing. But if they just ate a little bit, you know, on a regular basis, then, you know, like the Peruvians, that's their food. They eat quinoa, right? Not anymore. They can't afford it because now it's all being exported because, you know, in the West they'll buy it for ridiculous amounts. You know.
When Srila Prabhupada went to New Vrindavan one time, he noticed that there was hope weed growing. And none of the devotees understood that it was edible, but Prabhupada pointed it out. He's like, actually, yeah, you can eat this. So the devotees started, you know, they'd ask him how to do it, and he'd tell them. And then in a matter of days, every preparation had hope weed in it.
Yes, even the sweet rice.
Poke weed pakoras, poke weed sabzi, there was poke weed in the rice, it was like...
Oh, it's like, you can eat it.
Yeah, so it's like, you know...
Was there that much poke weed, or after 2 weeks it was gone?
Yeah, growing wild.
Okay, no, but I'm just going to
say... Run out of it in this area, they have so many acres.
Okay, and another one, okay.
But it was like, yeah, there was, everybody just went bats about it, and you know... It's edible. It's not, don't put it in everything. It just means that you can use it sometimes.
Krishna. Yeah. It's always that.
I was thinking that maybe because the strong desire to control, here in Western, they have these tendencies.
Yeah, because then you're stronger, you control, but also you enjoy because your health will be better. It's just over the top. So the thing is if that's the thing that's an advantage, if they get into Krishna consciousness, it'll be, you know, fanatic. But at the same time, as if they have proper association and everything like that, and study and all that, you know, in other words, follow the process as is recommended, then that purification and all that maturity will come, then they'll start to balance out.
That story with the seven up also, same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I had it one time, and then all of a sudden there were like cases of seven up outside of his door, and he's like, never mind. Yeah, I don't want that. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it turns into.
Yeah, but why is it that Prabhupada ate chapatis? Why isn't there a stack of chapatis outside when they go, you know, gallons of, you know, huge, you know, 100-gallon drums of sweet rice?
So it's something we can relate to.
Yeah, it's something we're into.
During the COVID time, there were two rats talking, so one of them was asking the other, so, did you take the vaccine? And he said, no, I'm not crazy. I wait for the human experiment to go on.
Yes. Yes. So his point is that all these have validity in context of Krishna consciousness. So it's the same thing that Jiva Goswami is saying. It's just, here you're applying logic, there they're applying religion, because it's a religion of logic, but then the human religion, that's a varnashram, that's also the religion of anything when it's connected to Krishna, just like you see the pots, they have a religion, what they do. When that's used to please Krishna, in service to Him, then it has validity, it becomes spiritual. If it's not, then it's just ordinary. Riti. Having discussed on the first Pradartha called Pramana, the next few sutras elaborate on the second Pradartha called Prameya. Right? So Pramana, so then we have Pratyaksha, Anuman, and Shabda. And then Gautama, because it works, it's useful within the, the logic, the
Avayavas,
right? So within that syllogism, the fourth part, to pull it together, right? So then the comparison is used. Though we can technically see it's just part of anima. Mm. But still, he brings it out because he wants to give each of the aspects of the avayavas a position based on authority, right? They're all based on praman, like that. And then, okay, that's the technique. It's based on praman. Now, what do you prove by that? That's prameya. So now he'll point that out. Sutra 119. Soul, atman, body, sharira, senses, indriya, objects of the senses, artha, intellect, buddhi, mind, manas, material activity, pravriti, fault, dosha, transmigration, preya, bhava, fruits of action, phala, suffering, dukkha, and liberation, apavarga, are the objects of valid knowledge, prameya. Notice he doesn't put happiness. It's not one of the objects. It's in the material world, you have suffering. That's the standard. You remove the suffering, you get happiness. So actually in the material platform, it's a negative. When you remove the material aspect of suffering, you get happiness. So it's not a positive.
Liberation.
Oh, I see. They're taking it. Liberation is happiness. Yeah, but that's then you remove the whole. But see is the body, the mind, the words, the objects of the senses. You know, the activity you can apply yourself to, the results you get from that activity, what's proper, what's improper, like that. Then the transmigration that you will go through based on that, like that. And then ultimately liberation. So these are the things to be established, right? So you see, that's a basis that everybody could discuss on, like that. And so then for our acharyas, they'll take it farther. You know, like that. But anybody in the Vedic culture could relate to this. That's the vritti. It's only a Sahaja Swami, the object of knowledge. Prameya may be translated as that which is knowable, or the object of true knowledge. That which is the object of cognition is prameya. Whatever is comprehended or cognized by buddhi is categorized into the 12 objects of cognition known as the prameyas. These 12 divisions are Atman, the self, Sharira, the body, the abode of the experience of pain and pleasure, that is the seat of all organic activities. Indriya, now in the contemporary, is it organic activities? Because nowadays there's so much artificial, you know, like that. But at the same time, everyone's talking about organic. You know, it's not something you have to get to, strive for. But before the 50s, that's all there was. There wasn't anything else. It's quite amazing, actually. Okay, indriyas, the 5 senses, smell, taste, touch, sight, and hearing, which contact external objects and transmit the experience to the mind. Artha, the objects of the senses. Buddhi, the artha, the objects of the sense, because it's something you want to gain. It means it doesn't become an object of the sense unless it's something you want to gain from it. Buddhi, cognition. Manas, the mind. The internal sense that is concerned with the perception of pleasure, pain, and all other internal experiences. And that, according to Nyaya, limits cognition to time and space. Okay, so the mind limits it to time and space. So unless you're working from Shastra, the mind will naturally bring it down, because it's only interested in what's around that you can perceive with the senses, and that you can get a benefit from.
So those who are talking about time, place, and circumstance in the incorrect way are the mental platforms.
Yes. Yes, because they're looking at it from their perspective on how they're going to... In other words, it's... time, place, circumstances are the secondary elements, but you have to see it in context of the primary.
Absolutely.
But they'll take it that they stand on their own, and because, oh, this is a different place, therefore, like what Matthew was saying before, is that, oh, we're going to this, what do you call it?
Interfaith
meeting, and so we don't want to disturb the other faith, so therefore we'll show up looking like bums, you know? And that, and see, that's the thing is, Now, it might be actually a good thing, because most other religions and all that are very kind to the, you know, how you say? Yeah, to those who are unfortunate. Yeah. And so that they give in charity, they're kind to them. So by showing up as slobs, then they might be kind to you.
My own floor with a bottle and a cup of coins in front of
you. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. Yes. Okay. But that's interesting, the time and space. Yeah, because the mind limits it to time and space, because the mind can't go beyond. It's the mind can only analyze what comes in from the senses. Senses can only work in time and space. Right? Intellect can go a little bit beyond that, can analyze. But it'll still, because it's going to be regulated by the mind, and what's valued by the mind is still going to be regulated by time and space. Polluted consciousness will be the same, so only if you use pure consciousness, then you can go beyond time and space.
So this is a confining agent that confines us into the material understanding, the mind.
The mind, yes. Think of mind. That's why Krishna says it's the best friend or the worst enemy. If it's focused on the external energy, it's the worst enemy. If it's focused on transcendence, on Krishna, then it's the best friend.
So when devotees have a problem understanding how Ugrasena had so much personal guts, that means they let the mind narrow their spiritual understanding.
Yeah.
It is possible, actually.
What you should do is put out a message, you know, on whatever medium gets out there, about anybody has a doubt about this. Then, once you get all the persons that are there, then you organize a trip to Calcutta, to Butter Bazaar, in the middle of the day. And once they see that, then they'll be good. You know, you moved around and there, then you're all right. Because they're just not used to seeing many people, right? So they can't. It's just like when they have these marches in D.C., then sometimes 500,000, 1,000,000 people come, and they're all packed into that place. Yeah, sometimes they always like to stand in front of the Lincoln Memorial. You know? And there's not that much space, because in the middle is a huge pond. And 1,000,000 people are there. So if 1,000,000 people could fit into that place, you know, which otherwise would take up, you know, a huge amount of some country somewhere, then why can't you have that many bodyguards? You know, and you are talking about Westerners, right? And they think in European spacing. And so if it was Indians or Orientals, you could fit 2,000,000 into the place, even more. No?
Well, for two reasons, because they're generally smaller than Americans, and also because
they don't mind being closer.
Yeah, they don't mind being closer.
Yeah, yeah. I know I've sometimes freaked out people, you know, in the West, and you're so used to in India that the closest spacing, you're just right next to them when you talk, and they're freaking out. You know, step back and adjust your spacing. The mind is compared to an atom, not the atom of modern physics, see Vaisheshika philosophy, because it is minute, everlasting, individual, and all-pervading. Okay. It's also an atom. So that's how we got? We only have an atom of mind? Oh my God. When we're so confident on how big our mind is, or how big our intelligence is. I mean, if we are 1/10,000 the tip of the hair, right? So therefore, then, how much one atom of mind, one atom of intelligence, one atom of falsity is all you need, right? You don't need a whole lot.
How does the Vaisheshika philosophy?
He's just pointing out the atom of modern physics. Because modern physics takes the one with all the... it takes the one that all the... that the molecules are made out of.
Right.
As the atom. But Vaisheshika says it's the smallest particle. So that means since these modern atoms... The modern atoms, they have parts. So Vaisheshika is actually smaller than that.
Okay. So would that be like the hex atoms when we're talking about time? And what is it? Which means with that? Or what? The hex atoms, like the
because then you see
pass through the screen and you can measure time that way.
Yeah. Yeah, it was talking about actual atoms.
Okay.
It's not talking about these. It's not talking about the guy in the apple either. Because the time it would take for the sun to pass over here would be a long time. If you call that a truthy or whatever it is, it wouldn't get very far. You know, if you stuck six atoms together, they'd be very big. Your time would be off.
May I ask about the you can see that Jaya philosophers and Vedanta philosophers were mentioned very often, but Vaisheshika philosophers not. Does it mean in the Middle Age it was not so much popular?
The point is that Vaisheshika, then his point is just adding in about the atoms. So you have the logic, but you add in the elements of the material energy is all atoms. So actually everything comes from atoms and everything goes back to atoms. Like that. Though, I don't know why, but in the 60s they still canceled the show. But, you know. But the point is the atoms, it's just everything goes back to that. So it's just another way of becoming detached. You know, the body is atoms, so it'll go back to atoms. The house is atoms, you know. you know, that $100 bill that you have, if you leave it outside too long, it will also go back to Adam's. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, if you probably check, that you find that there's, you know, even though it's not registered anywhere, but, you know, Adam and company actually controls the whole economics of the planet because he's been at it the longest. You know, the front's an apple business. You know, they look like regular fruit sellers, but actually behind the scenes, they control everything. No?
And you reach this conclusion by thinking logically, which is nyaya. So
yes.
Logical thinking, you understand
everything. Yes. So it's basically, the Prabhu was saying, you'll see the logic, because the two go together. But the emphasis will be on the logic. While you see with Shankya and yoga, then the emphasis will generally be on yoga. That becomes the prominent. You know, and then between Mimamsa and Vedanta, Vedanta will be the prominent. Like that. Though you do have people that karma is prominent for them, so they bring it down there, or the analyzing and like that. So you have. But Vaisheshika is just the aspect that is there, is this the everything comes from atoms. Like you see, it's the primary creation. And when you have the pradhan, then when Krishna glances, then it separates into the 24 elements. But that's the atoms. Right? Because otherwise, before, those atoms are homogeneous. And then they separate. But you still can't do anything with them until Krishna enters them. By entering them, he creates the attraction, because he's the attractive force. So then the atoms can come together and form things. So I think his philosophy is you just analyze it till it's back to atoms, and then you lose your interest in it. Right? You know, it's just like, let's say it was your birthday, you know, and so then people thought, okay, you know, we should get something really nice, right? So then, let's say you get some item, I don't know, all that comes to my mind generally is like a car or something, or let's say a phone, like that. You get you the latest phone. But then they take it down to the shop because they really want to show you everything, and you get one of those nice big, you know, squares that has the velvet on it and all that, you know, the little edge so nothing falls off. You know, like a meter by meter, you know, like that. Then you take it down to the expert there, and he takes the phone apart completely, down to every screw, every button, everything's taken apart. There's nothing connected together. And you lay it out very nicely on the thing, you know? So all that, you know, 1,000 pieces are all there. Right? Then I put a nice, like, you know, some kind of nice cloth over the top, like that, and then when it's time, it'll say, happy birthday, and, you know, give you this, and they say, what's this? It's a phone. Are you interested? No. So that's the point of Vaisheshika's philosophy. Dismantle it down to the atoms, nobody cares, and so therefore then they're happy to go for liberation. But that's it. That's. I don't know that there's more to the philosophy than that. You know?
When I was a student, I tried to preach to my scientific director, God consciousness. I was not devoted to him, but I tried to preach him Bible. And he told me I lost the faith in God when I studied atomic philosophy.
Yeah. So everything goes. But then they're just atoms also, so then...
I couldn't find God there, so you broke it, everything to the smallest.
Yeah.
And God was not there.
So. No, God was not there, yeah, but if you take your toaster and break it down, God's not there either, so then, you know, neither is the president, so...
I just saw something on the internet recently. It's, you know, an astronaut, and he's up on the... somewhere or something. He's holding a sign that says, I see no God here. And then someone comment, take off your helmet, you'll see him real quick.
Okay. I see no God here.
Because even the, so Nikola Tesla, for example, physicist, so he analyzed things by taking them apart and studying them, and he even understood that the life was separate from the material elements.
Mm-hmm.
And so he started studying the Puranas, because probably he wanted to understand it to the point where he can exploit it and make a renewable energy source.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, either way, he understood that there was something there, because, you know, otherwise how could it be operating? There's some sort of power source.
Yeah, that's the power.
And so we started studying Puranas. So at some point, you know, it was scientific, but then then the followers then sort of drop that aspect of it and just say, no, if we can't actually hold it or quantify it, you know, with instruments, then it can't exist.
Yeah, but you can't quantify that their attachment to, you know, whatever mundane things they are, because if you say that's not real, then it doesn't matter. Like, what do you call it? Then you just, they say, you know, just before he gets up to this, you know, he had a big conference, he's getting up on the thing like that, and then you just get up and come up to him and whisper in his ear, you know, about how, you know, how you say, this other professor that he hates is at your home with your wife now, and you saw him in a compromised position, and then you see how well he gives his lecture.
Mm.
So that's the whole thing, is they say all this stuff, but then they don't apply it to themselves. Yeah, so that's why that's what it is, because you use logic to come to analyze back to the atoms. So it's not that he's not going to use logic, it's just that's how he gets to the liberated point, because Gotama is just, you analyze these things and you come to the point that, you know, liberation is important, that this is another aspect. Where it's just the material energies of all atoms. So even these 12 are made of atoms, so. Mind is compared to an atom because it is minute, everlasting, individual, and all-pervading. Pravritti, activity. Focal, mental, physical. Dosha, mental defects that include attachment, raga, hatred, dvesha, and infatuation or delusion, moha. Right, so it's just, all it is that he chose these 12, and then all other definitions that are there in the Vedas will be connected into these 12. Like, we'll use another form of it. You know, the Dasamulas Lord Chaitanya gives, and everything will go there. But it's not contradictory.
Mm-hmm.
Because it'll still be what he puts here under mind, that'll still be in that area when you're dealing with mind. It's just the mind may not be a main element, but it will be. Does that make sense?
Yeah, Krishna in 11 camp, he says that all these sages, they were working on the mind energy, so they could say anything without contradicting actually. So everything makes sense. I mean, exactly this is what you're explaining.
Mm-hmm.
They just use different categorization. They say the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just what... They use a categorization that's good for their particular perspective. So if you're just looking at logic, then this is what's the thing, that this is what you're supposed to logically analyze, not other things. If you're analyzing something else, not seeing it in that whole point of up to Apavarga, then what's the point? Yeah, and just ours works best. If you want to get to Vrindavan, we use our system. If you want to get somewhere else, use someone else's system. So. Pratya Bhava, rebirth or life after death. Phala, the fruits or results of action experienced as pain or pleasure. Dukkha, suffering, the bitter or undesired experiences of mind. And Apavarga, liberation or complete cessation of all suffering without any possibility of its reappearance. Right? So, the real, without any possibility of its reappearance. So they're looking at it, it means if they're not on the devotional platform, they're looking at it from the point of it's you won't get involved again in this life. But once you come to the liberated platform, unless they take up devotional service, they will come back. You know, like that. According to Nyaya philosophy, the goal of life is to understand these 12 aspects of reality, the pramayas as they actually are. Bondage is born of the, I guess, misunderstanding, no? Mm-hmm. Of these 12 knowable objects. And one attains freedom from bondage when he attains the correct knowledge, okay, of these 12 aspects of reality. And so if you have the proper understanding of these 12, then you'll attain liberation because you'll give up the material endeavor. Most of the time, however, this knowledge remains incomplete, and the means for attaining an integral comprehension of reality is not learned. So defective or invalid knowledge is maintained, because he only gives the system. He doesn't actually do it. Like this, that's the whole point. There is no sadhana. He just shows what logic is. He doesn't take you through. He just says, here's the logic, here's what you should logically analyze, and then everybody will do it on their own. In order to cast off this invalid knowledge, Nyaya provides a profound method for determining valid knowledge. This is studies under the category Praman, which will be discussed following brief discussions of the other 14 components in the Nyaya process for attaining valid knowledge. Sutra 1.1.10. The characteristics, lakshana of the soul, are desire, icha, aversion, dvesha, endeavor, prayatna, pleasure, sukha, suffering, dukkha, and knowledge, jnana. Right, so now these are the breakdowns of the soul. So each of the 12 will have their breakdowns. The soul, commentary by Vatsyayana Rishi. The soul, when it comes across an object which previously resulted in pleasure, desires to attain the same. Such a desire to attain the object is the characteristic feature of the soul. Because recognition, prati santana, takes place only in the case of the same subject, the soul, perceiving different objects at different times. Right? So it has to be the same soul. Otherwise, if there was no soul, then what is perceiving? Right? Because there's a singular soul. So there's not multiple souls, so there's not no soul. Because you can say, oh no, but you know, the senses and the mind and all this can do. But the point is, why do the senses care? Right? The senses are there when in a dead body. They don't care. Right? So that's the thing, is the senses, the mind, the intelligence, they absolutely don't care. It's only because the living entity is interested, therefore something happens. Just like, let's say, you could say, no, but they do their job anywhere. That produces, no, it's like you're sitting there and doing something like we call daydreaming, right? You're sitting there and looking out the window. So many things are going on around you, but you don't hear any of it or care about any of it. You have some other thing that you're thinking about. You know, like it says here, you looked out the window, you saw the bird, the tree, a bird. That bird reminds you of something, and you're thinking about that because that gives you happiness. But what's going on in the classroom, you couldn't care less. Like that. So it's the soul. It's not the senses. It's not the mind. It's the soul has an interest in that. And so the mind then goes through the process.
It's a tool.
Yes, it's a tool. Yeah, and that's what also Krishna says. He says, you know, it's either your best friend or it's a tool. Right? Yeah. They still use that term anymore, someone's a tool?
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, it goes back to Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, yeah, I'm very Tejagat. The superior energy always looks for opportunity to exploit the inferior energy.
Inferior, yes. Because they're looking for the pleasure. Pleasure means you're going to exploit it in some way. Like that. Because it's not service, it's exploitation. On the spiritual platform, it's service. So that's why you say seva. Like that. That's the whole thing. So you say, oh, no, but you just have the Bob, like we're saying before. You didn't just God you worship. Any, what worship are you doing? What service are you doing in the middle of the field? You know, if you say, oh, we don't have to. It's just a matter of, it's not a matter of all these rules and regulations. We just, you know, do as we like and so they go, where's the service? That's the thing. You feel like chanting, so you're chanting. They're nice, but it's not about Krishna. You know, it's connected to Krishna, you get benefit, but it still doesn't have the same application as if you actually appreciate it. You know, that it's service to Krishna. How it's service. So that's the thing. Service must be seen. That's the main thing. Everything else, if it doesn't support service, it has no validity. Unless it increases service, what's the value? You know, so that's the difficulty, all these things, you know, what's right and wrong. How is it supporting service? Right, so like we said before, that example, when the service was just getting some nice flowers for the deities, then they'd hop over into the cemetery and bring flowers. And so it's service. And so therefore it's valid. But when the consciousness you know, gets purified and you see is that you wouldn't offer, since it's for Krishna's pleasure, why would you offer, you know, impure flowers from the cemetery? Therefore then you give that up. Now it's not service. Not going to the market and buying, or, you know, going around to all the walas and asking him to give something for Krishna and things like that. And so, you know, they do. And so like that, then it becomes service. But the point is, you have to see is where's the service. Otherwise, you say, "Oh, you can't do this." Where's the service? You can do this. Where's the service? You know, oh, we shouldn't disturb anybody else. Okay, where's the service? I shouldn't disturb anybody else. Why? Where's the service? Right? Does that make sense? So in that way, then the communications people, they're famous for never wearing devotional clothes as a rule. They never, even they go to the temple, they don't wear it. So many of them I've seen. I mean, some may. But I'm saying, it's like a rule, but where's the service? Because they're saying, no, I can't wear devotional clothes. It'll give a bad impression of the movement. So then you think devotees look bad. You think it looks weird. So how is it service? What service are you doing? Oh, it's for the reputation of the society. How is the reputation be? What actually you're doing? They don't even know you're a devotee. You walk down the street, they don't know. How is it service? Right? Somebody says? Yes.
Always one question about practical situation. For example, today morning I was listening to lecture of Srila Prabhupada, and he said that Brahmana always should share the truth even if you leave some disturbance to society and to him. And when we see such types of deviations in every Krishna consciousness society, should we say always?
The thing is you have to see, means if you can, you'll say something. Because the point is it's truthful. But the thing is truthful doesn't mean you just say anything. You have to say it properly according to who you're talking to. You know, that's why it also says that in Gita then about austerity of speech, is saying things that don't, the words themselves and how you present it aren't disturbing. You know, it may be the message they don't like, but at least the words are pleasant and nice. So that's the austerity of the speech. I think I have to work on that one.
In our area, in Asia, our tradition always to say only soft way words and never disturb everyone. And that's why we always have this part, but to say truth is very difficult.
Yeah, but you try to word it so the truth could be said. You know, like that. But or you bring it down the step. Like that. But you also have to see it's because that's for himself, but if it's for something greater, then what's the point? They take it as, there's a saying, what's that called? It's a position. I heard about it in the West. It's something where they tell the truth no matter what. It's like a vow. In the Western, especially, I think it's more in the, I've seen it more in the techie world, and but some people do it, they get into it.
Netherlands.
Oh, that's just, yeah. But it's not that they present the culture way, they just bluntly say everything, but that's not meaning of truth. That may be facts, but truth is how it connects to Krishna. So on the Brahminical platform is there, but it has to be, how does it connect to Krishna? So therefore, what's the service? What's the understanding? What's the service? What's the ultimate goal? To please Krishna. So then one needs to see those aspects and then see what's the proper way to speak. Like you see his Prabhupada, like you see his... would stick to things, but he would also say something that would go. You know, it's just like Prabhupada saying, yes, and so... So, you know, the saffron, things like that, is some interview. And something the guy says, oh, so then the saffron is what's important. You have to wear saffron. He says, no, it's not about the saffron. Like that. So it could be any color, you know, like that. Yes, it could be. So we could wear blue or this and that. And probably say, yes, saffron. And then, you know, because... Why get into this? The guy, he's making this whole thing about the color when it's about Krishna consciousness. And then you'll spend the whole show talking about saffron and why and this and that and isn't this and what about that. They won't listen about Krishna. So Krishna's the real thing. So he's trying to say, and say it nicely, but at the same time as you have to get to the point, real truth is Krishna. This whole thing of truth means facts. No, that's not. Truth means what it is. The facts may be what they are. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So it's just like, let's say, you have a child, you know, especially a very small child. They're uneducated. They're uncultured. They don't know how to behave. They're completely uncontrolled in their senses. They're completely self-centered. They think the whole world revolves around them and that everybody should be doing everything for them. These are facts. But would you say that's the truth? The truth is that they're young and immature, and therefore then you try to help them and train them and as much as possible. Otherwise, if you had an adult with those qualities I just mentioned, basically no one would associate with them. Because the adult, if they have that, that is truth. But with a kid, that's not the truth. The truth is they're just mature, they have to grow up. So they work it on what is politically going to give an advantage. So then they talk about truth. Because if they say facts, then if you say facts, then there's so many facts. You know, if the guy is so interested in truth, why does he have a very big salary? And his salary is probably way more than the common man. So how, in truth, how does he accept that? Because he's for everyone's equal and everybody's like that, have an opportunity. Why is his salary 2 to 3 times that of the common person? Shouldn't he, in truth, accept only a smaller amount? Since it's about truth, why should he be taking advantage of truth and making money off of truth? Isn't that worse? Isn't the guy who's just a gross materialist, isn't he better than the guy who, in the name of truth, is just a mercenary? You know, so is that, it means you tell that to the journalist, is that going to go down well? Yes.
This verse is from Manusmriti, you know, that Satyam Bruyat Priyam Bruyat Na Bruyat Satyam Apriyam. People quote only this. It means speak the truth pleasantly. Speak pleasantly. Do not speak the truth in an unpleasant manner. Verses say, do not speak the truth in unpleasant manner. Don't speak the truth if it is unpleasant. Many people translate like that, but here, I think some devotee translated. Do not speak the truth in unpleasant manner. But that's still the half the verse. And the next part is, even if pleasant, do not speak the untruth. Even if it is pleasant, shouldn't speak the untruth. This is the path of eternal religion. This is from Manusmriti.
So speak the truth pleasantly.
Speak pleasantly. Do not speak in an unpleasant way. Just means using truth as an excuse for venting out your anger.
Yeah.
That you shouldn't do. And if untruth, even if it is pleasant, you should never speak it. Mm-hmm. No prajalpa, in the name of
being pleasant.
So basically hardcore preaching, softcore preaching, both is smashed in the name of
just do the
preaching. That's the middle part.
Mm.
Don't do this and that and both and
Maharaj, I thought in your workshop, Goswami Maharaj, once again Goswami Maharaj, he said, if you want to inspire someone to do something good, we can say him, you have this good quality, even if he hasn't. We can see a seed of this quality in him and say, you have it, and after that he will appear as this quality. And I want to, but in this, according to this aphorism, it will not be true if you will say to someone, you are very brave, for example, but he is not so much brave. And can we do it for inspiration or not?
You have to see, because Prabhupada talks about when you're talking with people about flattery. But the thing is you're taking some elements there, you might increase it beyond what it is, but you say they're brave, but why are they in that situation unless there's some braveness? They're just not brave enough. So in other words, there's a quality that's there that's not enough. So then you're bringing that out to so that they'll make the further endeavor to take it farther. You know what I'm saying? But, if the guy's locked in his basement, in his bunker, and won't come out, like that, then you might not use the term brave. You could say as you're, serious about safety. In other words, find some quality he's manifesting and look at the good side of it rather than the bad side. Like the child, the dependent. So therefore, you bring that out, rather than the negative side of those things. So that's the thing, is that if you want to, means the proper is you bring out the good side and let it develop. But then we see in the political field and all that, they'll take the negative of it, because everything has a negative. And it's like saying, fire has smoke, so therefore smoke is bad, so therefore there should be no fire. No, it's just, you use it in the right situations. So you just have to, because otherwise if you just do it like that sentimentally, then at some point it will go. But you can only use that on somebody who will bring it about. Like if you tell the kid, like the boy, you're brave, then he becomes brave, then that means that the quality is there. You can do something with it. But if you say, you're brave, no, like this, then why use that one? Shift to something else. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Shri Prabhupada ki jai.